Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into this wide-ranging and awesome chat with Adam Curry, the podfather himself, about everything from his early MTV days, Trump and New York in the 80s, the CIA, institutional corruption today, how ECG acts as an attack vector on the petrodollar, and how Bitcoin is America 2.0, I want to tell you about our amazing sponsors. Ledin is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. Ledin.io is the first digital asset lender with the transparency and security of a formal proof of reserves attestation. You can also borrow against your Bitcoin if you don't want to sell, or you can use their B2X program to double your stack. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast get $10 in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan today. If you want to see what it's all about, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. You need to secure your Bitcoin from physical disaster and a single point of failure. And the best way to do that is with a CipherSafe seed storage device. CipherSafe's goal is to provide important, tangible security tools for Bitcoin. CipherSafe focuses on securing your Bitcoin with beautiful, elegant, and practical devices. Designed, engineered, and manufactured all in-house. Machined from solid stainless steel, not stamped out. Waterproof, fireproof, rustproof, and tamper-proof. The Cypher wheel is designed to be physically locked with a padlock and comes with a tamper evidence seal so you can be aware of any attempts to steal your seed words. To keep your sat safe, go to cyphersafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Adam Curry.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Adam Curry is an internet entrepreneur, former MTV VJ, and the podfather. He is the co-host along with John C. Dvorak of the No Agenda podcast. Adam Curry, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix. How are you?
Cedric, I'm good, man. Thank you. That was literally my Wikipedia page, wasn't it?
close. Maybe something like that. Definitely close. I definitely did go to your Wikipedia page. You know, but besides being the podfather, and, you know, I have to thank you for that because here I am podcasting. And so we owe a lot to you and this media forum. But, you know, I grew up watching, you know, you guys on MTV. You included as well.
Wait, Cedric, how old are you, man? That's not possible. You don't look old enough to have been watching me. What were you, two?
No, I was probably a little older than that. So I was probably about somewhere 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I was born in 77. So by 6, and we always had cable. We had that box, that brown box with the three rows and go up and down and 2 to 14 and 15
right.
And
how,
up.
Yeah, well, how many channels do you have? 16 at the time? 16 channels probably?
I don't know. We had a box for 36, but...
Oh, really? Oh,
42?
Oh, high tech.
I don't think everyone was filled.
42, yeah.
But, you know, and when MTV came out, that kind of felt fresh. It kind of felt like a different voice being heard in the media landscape. Looking back on it, I don't know how much that voice was different from, you know, say something more mainline, but it did seem fresh and new. And I'm kind of curious what it was for like for you in the early days.
Well, that's a good question. Interestingly enough, no one has really asked me the question that way exactly. When MTV first started, it was basically Wayne's World. I mean, it was pirate radio. It was very, very low budget. It was, you know, rough and raw. And I wasn't there in the very beginning. That was 1981.
Right.
I came in 87. And this was when MTV was going to basic cable. And this was a big deal. So there was like 5-6 years of MTV that was really just kind of in the margins. And cable itself, excuse me, I do have a little throat thing. It's like my COVID My long COVID is what I blame everything on long COVID. Hey, I forgot to take the trash out, honey. Long COVID, can I tell you? It's like, I got brain fog. But it has affected my voice somewhat. So a couple of things, you know, when you go to basic cable, that was, oh my goodness, you know, now we have to be a little careful about what we say. We have to, you know, respect the watershed line, which is 10 p.m. That's when you can be a little more risque on cable. But also cable itself was having to prove itself. People are like, this is not television. No one's going to advertise on this crap. No one's interested in this. That was, of course, broadcast. So I came in right when the commercialization was kind of taking place. And I'm really good at that, or I certainly was. I suck at it now. I don't think I could do it. But I could help pitch, and, you know, we put together pitches for Budweiser. That's actually, just to give an example, this is early when I was there, maybe a year. And I was very involved with the music programming at the time and anything. And I'm interested in making the whole product great. And I understood the overall product. There was a lot of radio guys who were running it, mm-hmm. which was interesting by itself because, you know, they would do call out research and they'd play a song over the phone to somebody and say, what do you think? Well, I like the song, but, you know, I'm like, dude, you're missing a whole piece of the equation here. It's like people, it's the videos, you know, this is right. The whole thing. So, but there was still a lot of good knowledge in there. And just like in any radio station or radio project, hey, how can I help you sell the advertisers? And they wanted to get Budweiser advertising on the channel. You know, we had no beer right. sponsor. I don't think we had any alcohol sponsor. And they had this great idea. And we put together a pitch reel for it, you know, as if kind of, you know, fake, as if we're there with blue screen at the time. This is before green screen. Mm-hmm. We use blue as the color to key on, believe it or not. And so they came up with Spring Break. You know, MTV didn't go to Florida for Spring Break. No, we went there to get Budweiser on the channel. So there was that going on at the same time. It was still incredibly low tech. We had no makeup, no wardrobe. I did have a dressing room, which is that was luxury. That's even more luxurious if you get a dressing room anywhere. And the lighting guy would come in, you know, once a week and say, stand on that X there. Okay, that's your spot. And he'd bang the lights around. Okay, you're good. I'll see you in a week. Don't grow. And but it still had a cool ass pirate vibe to it. And it was almost from the minute I got there, I could see how the corporate influences were playing out. Mm. You know, it's like, don't say anything bad about Madonna because we wanted to perform in the Video Music Awards.
Right.
And a famous story I tell is, we were going to have Michael Jackson, I think, perform, but certainly premiere his new video at some point. And this was a little bit later on when videos were more of a commodity and, you know, more channels could planetary premiere them. My mm-hmm. God, I'm remembering all this shit.
Yeah.
And so we had to do a Michael Jackson special weekend, which is fine. You know, it's Michael Jackson weekend, everybody. It's great. We'll premiere this video. But part of the written agreement was every single time you say Michael Jackson, you had to say Michael Jackson, comma, the king of pop. And the way it worked, it was not live. Most of the programming was not live. So on Thursday, we tape for Saturday and Sunday, and Friday, we tape for Monday. So Thursday is called a double shift, you know, a 48. We got to do 48 hours of programming. So we're doing all this. We do all our Michael Jackson specials. And then Friday, we got a call early in the morning. It's like, it's going to be a long day. So what's going on? Well, cancel your life until 9 p.m. because we forgot to say Michael Jackson, the king of pop, in every single segment. So we have to retape everything. So what... Still, the vibe was there, and we were all in the vibe, but it was an incredible period of transition, and it was a lot more corporate than it probably showed.
Right.
To answer your question.
Yeah, that was awesome. How did you end up on MTV?
Well, I was working, I grew up in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. I moved there when I was seven with my parents, of course, and my two sisters. And I was working, I started in television, or I started in pirate radio when I was, when I was 15, 16, building transmitters, broadcasting illegally. You know, my mom would actually, bless her heart, drive me around the block, see how far my signal reached. But, you know, I got into some pretty big pirate stations. And it was very government controlled at the time in the Netherlands. So, and I broke into television at 19 and was doing a weekly program live for the whole country. The country only had two TV stations. So there were seven, you know, half the country, 14 million people at the time, was watching me on Sunday night. There was nothing else to watch. And at the time, the Netherlands was a gateway to Europe. Mm. So we had all the big stars coming through. At the time, it was David Bowie, Diana Ross, Janet Jackson, Michael Jackson, Tina Turner, you know, all these iconic 80s names, because this is now we're going to 83, 84. So I made quite a name for myself. And the main thing, my hook was I could pronounce words in English, I could speak fluently, and I could speak with artists who typically were like, oh, I'm in this another, you know, they think Holland, isn't that Scandinavia, whatever. And they're like, they're expecting some stupid interviewer who goes, so tell me, what is this song about? And instead they got a fun conversation. So it was really good. It was great. I got comfortable with my craft. I learned a lot about making television, because this was in opposition to MTV. These were 12 camera shoots, three makeup rooms, you know, dressing rooms as big as an apartment. This was all government money. So I really learned with the best of the best and the best technology at the time. I learned how to do every single piece in the entire production chain. I loved it. And MTV called me out of the blue. I was at my desk at the in Holland and said, hey, you want to come and work for us? So what? So yeah, to where? And they had just started MTV Europe at the time in 87. I said, MTV Europe? Said, no, New York. Like, yeah, okay, when? Tell me when you want me. Can you come next month? I said, yeah, I'll be there in 2 months. No problem. And that's how it started. And I stayed at MTV for a little over 7 years.
Wow. And I mean, you've obviously made a career in communications. Do you like the whole thing, or is it really about the person-to-person communications? Is it the production? Is it the transmission? What do you think about it, the art form or the medium that's made you a lifelong sort of user or creator?
So the technology is a big part of it. For whatever reason, I've been part of technological innovations when I was broadcasting. So pirate radio, cable television, podcasting. And I am a radio guy at heart, 100% radio guy. And radio guys, certainly up until, you know, 20 years ago, you had to know a lot about engineering, technology, sound, mixing, recording, because a disc jockey does it all. He does it all himself, you know. And I have actually recorded this once or twice when we do No Agenda. I've recorded my hands and my screen so people can see what I'm doing. What they don't hear, you know, I'm looking for clips. I'm searching for stuff. I'm mixing. I'm adjusting a noise gate. You know, all the, while talking. So this is very, you know, this kind of like, you know, rub your belly, pat your head. That's what DJs do. So for me, it was very almost second nature to just always be involved. And by the way, also a thing radio guys do is always working on their sound. I want more compression. I want more of this. I want a better microphone. You know, always I want bigger balls. I want to sound good. So all this stuff. So, and I was, you know, I kind of grew up in the age of 80s, Z Morning Zoo, Top 40 radio, you know, hit formats. And I love radio. And for me, that really goes back to when I was 7 years old, when my grandmother gave me as a gift, it was a Sony transistor radio, solid state, mind you, 9-volt battery in a very handsome leatherette carrying case. And I would listen under my pillow at night to the basketball games. And I'm not a sports guy at all, but I loved listening to the mix and the announcers and the squeaking of the of the shoes on the floor, and that you can hear the backboard and just all the, and the crowd and the levels. And I was just fascinated because it gave me a theater of the mind, which is very analogous to when you're reading a book. You know, you see, you envision something. And I really came to love that. And it was weird because when I was 17, I was doing a pirate show or a show on Saturday night in Amsterdam. When they were playing, when the government radio station was playing polka music, that was their top 40 station. We were playing Chicago Warehouse. And we were getting import records, and we were, I mean, it was crazy. People were hanging outside the studio. I mean, there was no secrets. It was like, we were like heroes of the nightlife in Amsterdam. And I did my show in English, which was appropriate for Amsterdam. But somehow people thought that I was like 24, I was 17. That was 24, clearly a black guy. And I just made up that I drove a Harley. And to me, now, of course, these days, oh my God, cultural appropriation. But, you know, people were just, hey, you sound like you're black. So, yeah, I am. Yeah, I'm 25 and I got a Harley. And that was this John Holden was my name. And this persona, because you couldn't use your real name because you could get arrested and go to jail. And I love trying to figure out how I could be this guy and the sound and how would he sound. And that has always been something that I really, really love. So the passion that and the technology folds into what I'm actually good at, I think. And funny enough, it's what our 44th president would call a community organizer. I am pretty good at organizing people. Not that I'm trying to organize them, but I know how to communicate and talk to people. And over the years, I've built great systems and automation into my life so I can categorize, know what one person said 2 years ago, bring stuff in, tag stuff. I mean, I've built systems around this, which is kind of the only way that I can do what I do. And I guess I really noticed that I could combine all my talents when Dave Weiner and I created podcasting 1.0, now almost, well, the technology we did in 2000, but in, you know, 2003, 2004 is when really the podcasting part clicked. And it's by creating a show. I created a show called The Daily Source Code, and the audience was software developers who would create podcast apps. Now, we didn't have phones and apps at the time, so it was an actual program that ran on your Windows or your Mac computer. But it could sync to your iPod or your Zune, for those of you old enough to remember. And so I was making a show for them. Now, I'm not a software developer. I know enough to understand it, and I understand the concepts, and I can look at some code and understand simple stuff, and I can understand it. I can visualize what's happening. I know how it works, and I've broken enough code to to know what it does. And that was it. It's like, oh, okay. So now I'm just doing a radio show, but instead of for people who want to hear top 40, I'm talking about them and talking about what they're building. And, you know, and so now the second time around with podcasting 2.0, I'm doing exactly the same. But now we have better tools. I mean, we didn't have Mastodon. We'd have Twitter. We didn't have any kind of social networks back then. And now we have GitHub, and we had, so there's all these great tools you can use to communicate, really, really communicate so effectively. I like doing it, and I think that it works, you know, and I get the satisfaction just really out of seeing people using something, doing something, being happy, being part of the community. Like when you say, thank you for creating podcasting. No, it's the other way around. Thank you. You're using this shit in ways that I didn't expect ever, you know, and it's just this basic concept that for me started, you know, many, many years ago. And so that's what I do, I guess. You know, I've made my career, you know, I have a sustaining income. I blew all the big money on stupid stuff and had a good time doing it. I married a woman with money. That was good. So there's a backstop. Mm-hmm. She's laughing as she heard me say that. Mm-hmm. just the whole package, but really not video per se for me at all. That's you know, MTV and doing television was just a part of it, and it's not something I enjoy. I don't really dig it that much. Audio was my thing.
Yeah, the audio ensemble. And I really connected with what you're saying about sort of old time sports, or even just sports on talk radio. I grew up listening to talk radio when I would go to work with my father, or a lot of times I got into it listening to a ball game and then listening to the after talk.
Ball games, another great audio experience. Yeah. Baseball game is a great audio experience.
Yeah, and there's a lot going on, and I've listened to your show where you and I've even heard you on other shows where you're bringing your dashboard and you're able to put a lot of sound effects into play very quickly while maintaining the conversation, which I think is an art form or a skill in itself.
Well, that is an art form. And I would say the man who developed that, well, there's guys who came before him, but where I learned it from is Scott Shannon. Scott Shannon in New York.
Yeah.
Z100. I adored him. My buddy and I, when we were in Holland, we'd rip off all his stuff. I mean, I still have a bell. That is a throwback to Scott Shannon's Morning Zoo. He always had a bell. And again, I'm sure he's not unique in it because the format was everywhere, but Scott was kind of a very special kind of radio guy. And I really, really adore him.
Did you get to meet those guys when you moved to New York with MTV?
This was crazy. I was doing an MTV promotion somewhere, and I guess it was something with Z100, and Scott Shannon's there. And I'm like, and you know, the old school radio guys, top 40 radio guys in New York in particular, they talk like this. Hey man, how you doing, man? And what's up? They gruntle. They're like, what's up, man? And I'm like, hey, Scott, it's really nice to meet you. And I've ripped you off so many times. And oh man, where you living, man? So I live in New Jersey. And I told him, I said, oh man, you're like two streets behind me. So, and then he said, hey man, give me an air check. Send me an air check. I know you got one. Send me an air check. And so I sent him an air check and he said, come on in, man. And he gave me a shift on Saturdays on Z100, which I love doing. And then I filled in for the Morning Zoo for during a whole like 3 months during the summer. I had my own top 40 top 30, Adam Curry's top 30 hit list syndicated radio show. So that was as good as working for MTV, maybe a little bit better, was bumping into Scott Chan and him hiring me to do stuff on the weekends and fill in. That was a big deal for me.
Right. Did you have a big deal, maybe like a highlight of an interview, someone that you got to interview that either, you know, it was a great interview or it was just like, wow, I got to interview that person?
There's so many interesting people I've met. It's hard to say which is the best because, I mean, one of the most, someone I met who I didn't interview, but I met and spoke with for an hour, which is about what an interview is, was Steve Jobs when he wanted to put podcasting into iTunes. Quincy Jones, I did an hour long live radio interview and call in show with him. And he brought in a bottle of Latour, which is like, I don't know, for some maybe $1,500, $2,000 bottle of wine, and he puts it right down in between us and he says, okay, let's have a chat. We were hammered within, you know, 30 minutes. It was like, this guy has produced Lena Horne to all the way to television Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, you know, the amazing guy, lots of stories. So, you know, I've always kind of enjoyed, my stories are about people I've met who had great stories. But the same I would say for, Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney was kind of fun. This is when I just got the TV gig. So I was 19, and because it was state-owned, state-run television, you had to, even though I was on television doing work, no, you still have to go through education. So we're going to give you interviewing classes. And you go to some gray building. I mean, very, very like Soviet Union type deal. Some gray building, and you sit there with a couple other new, young, fresh faces, and you get a Nagra, a portable recorder, which, you know, these days you just hold your iPhone up, but it was a thing like this. It weighed a ton because of the batteries. It was reel to reel, so you had to thread it all. You had a Sennheiser microphone, and you carried it over your shoulder. Now, okay, here's what you're going to do, and here's your subject, and go to the train station and interview some people. Okay. I said, I'll go do that. But tomorrow I'm interviewing Paul McCartney. Do you have any tips for me? So anyway, so I flew to London. We go to MPL, which is McCartney Publishing Limited. It's kind of like Scrooge McDuck, you know, the MPL logos on the door handles and on the carpets and everything. And we're getting set up. And again, this is also old school with, you know, three-man crew, one guy just to, you know, to turn the crankshaft, basically. We're talking old, old school shit. And Paul's in there. So we're talking. At the time, he had a film and a soundtrack out called Give My Regards to Broad Street. It was also going to be it was a video game. So this was the reason for the interview. And he, you know, and so we're sitting down. He said, oh, would you like a cup of tea? So we get some tea, you know, and we're drinking tea and we're chatting. We're talking about the project. And I don't know what I did, but somehow I kick over my tea, a big mug, and it goes psh, all over the MPL logo, this blue rich carpet. I'm like, oh, you know, so. Oh, now I'm on the ground. Now Paul's on the ground too. We're both dabbing up the tea on this MPL logo carpet. Ding, the elevator opens. Linda McCartney walks in. Oh, she's so now all three of us are on our knees. And I was just like, I just got to take a mental snapshot of this for a second. What is happening right here? So yeah. Those experiences, but also went to Moscow for the Moscow Music Peace Festival in 89 with Motley Crue, Bon Jovi, Skid Row, Ozzy Osbourne. I mean, I've been through some great, great rock and roll moments and some great fun times with very, very fun people.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Can we get a little, I'd like to flesh out maybe the technology side, like how did podcasting 1.0, like what was sort of, what happened there? How'd that come about? Like how'd it go from like more just talk radio to what we see it as now?
Well, it wasn't for broadcasting at all, actually. In 2000, I took a company public in 96 on NASDAQ and exited that company in just before the turn of the century and went back to live in the Netherlands for a while. And what they had there at the time was cable modems, and a lot of cable modems, and which is great because with a cable modem, it wasn't fast or anything, mm-hmm. but you didn't have to dial up. You didn't have to tie up your phone line. So, you know, there was this big process of just getting online that you didn't have to go through anymore. But of course, I was broadcast minded. And I'm like, well, video, you know, real video and, you know, QuickTime movies. And there was ways to do video. But it was horrible because if someone had a link to a video, you click on it, you wait 10 minutes for it to download. And I'm not kidding, 10 minutes. And then, you know, it's downloaded and you click on it, then it takes another 30 seconds to open some player, and then you get a minute of dumb video. Like, this is not an experience. And this is where my technology brain comes in. So, well, what if there was a little program and it knew what I wanted, and it was just waiting for that thing to be published. And the minute it's published, it downloads it, and then it tells me something is here. So I didn't lose those 10 minutes waiting because I didn't know. So, you know, that's kind of a good deal. I can save time with this and have a much better experience. Right. And at the time, Dave Weiner was building weblogs. He invented weblogs, and along with that, RSS, the really simple syndication format, was just a little text file, and it basically, and anyway, you can write it with it literally with Notepad if you want to, but it just says, here's an here's a show, here's the episode, or, you know, whatever you want to call it. And I said, dude, why don't we add an attachment to that, kind of like an attachment to an email? Now, this conversation wasn't going very well. So I flew to New York, where he was at the time, and I tried to convince him this would be a cool thing to do. I think he kind of thought, Hollywood douche, whatever. So that night I programmed the idea as best as I could in his software and demoed it to him the next day. And he said, okay, I get what you want to do. Yeah, I'll do it. But only under the condition you never, ever program in my software again. Cause that was just horrible. So, no problem. I won't do that. So he did it. And so we basically now had the enclosure or the attachment for RSS feeds. And he had the software called Radio Userland. So we could basically publish and receive and do this. And, you know, for 2 or 3 years, we had this working. We were the only guys using it. It was kind of cool because in the morning I go to my computer. Oh, there's 100 megabyte QuickTime video and I can play it and, you know, and I have an instant experience. Until I saw the iPod. I saw the iPod and went, holy crap, that's the same transistor radio my grandmother gave me. Same dimensions, you know, little cute little thing, solid state. It's not a Walkman or a digital jukebox. That's a radio receiver. I recognize this. And then I set about with my incredible software development skills to hack together an Apple script that would literally look at an RSS feed, look for a new enclosure and attachment, download it to the computer. Then back in the day, you had to connect your iPod to the computer. It would sync it, and then you'd pick it up. And instead of in the album name, it would have the name of the show, and underneath that, episodes. I'm like, boom. And then I started broadcasting. And right away, I'm like, it wasn't called a podcast. We had no name for it. This is a show. And hey, everybody, I need someone to fix this script for me because it sucks balls and doesn't work on Windows. And then guys showed up and they started developing podcast apps. And that's how it kind of got rolling.
Right. And what were the first few years like in terms of listeners? Was it like a snowball right away? Were it the tinkerers and the engineers and the developers who were listening? Was it a mix of people coming in because they heard about this new sort of medium?
Well, in the very beginning, it was just nerds. You know, we're just trying to figure out what the hell are we doing here. But pretty quickly, once we kind of figured out that these were shows, and you know, I drove that a lot because I'm a radio guy. So I'm like, oh, this is cool. I can do radio, which people can listen to when they're ready for it, not when I'm on air, and I can start it when I'm ready for it. That was even better. Any morning DJ will tell you that's a cool idea. It went so fast. I'm trying to think if there was a seminal moment. I think the BBC came to interview me, and when the BBC interviewed me, then there's a lot happening. And NPR got in pretty quick. Mm. I'll say that Tony Khan, WGBH in Boston, he really pushed NPR very hard to do this early on. And then the BBC started doing it, and, you know, they were on board really, really quickly. And I think that pushed it, which of course on one hand was great. On the other hand, when Apple put podcasting into iTunes, the homepage of iTunes was not the Daily Source Code, the Dawn and Drew Show, all these independent, cool, crazy ass programs. It was NPR and BBC, and it's like, oh, okay. I mean, we were in there, but we were not featured, which was kind of like, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah. But it went so fast. I mean, there was it was probably maybe a year or 2 years. I don't even know. I was just consumed by this. That's all I was doing all day long, was testing programs, working with developers, making shows, talking to other people, building the first directory, all this stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, it's a force that's, I mean, to be reckoned with, that's sort of out of control. I mean, the amount of people and the amount of time that people listen to podcasts. What has sort of been your mission or the ethos, specifically with like No Agenda, and how you're sort of looking at your audience? And I mean, and beyond, I mean, the noise atmosphere and the symphony you're creating is awesome, but how do you look at your audience? How do you look at this art form? You know, it's a little bit different. It's more long form. How do you think this connects with listeners in maybe a different way than other media?
Well, there's a couple things. What my mission is not necessarily the same thing as No Agenda. Mm. No Agenda is what John C. Dvorak and I are really good at, and that's deconstructing media. That's in the essence, that's all we're really doing. Now, do we go off the path sometimes and dive much deeper and do research and come up with hypotheses? Yeah, all the time, because that's fun to do. But in essence, we're saying the media is bullshit. Here's why. And we're going to break that down and we're going to show you all the tricks. I'm going to show you how lame it is. And it's just all, it's all phony because we both had a lifetime of careers in this business. So that's the essence of it. these days, fake news is now an understood thing. So it's gone to such a degree that, I mean, it's a little bit more than just that, because we started early on 15 years ago with what we call the value for value concept, which was, we knew that knowing media, the only way we could absolutely talk like two guys would just, that's how we started, just talking to each other. We're going to record it. We'll say whatever we want to say. We knew that was always going to be incompatible with corporate money or advertising. But we also knew that this was a lot of work. And if we wanted to really do it, we'd have to get paid. And what we discovered early on is if you ask people to send you what they think it's worth, which is really subjective and very individual, $5 may be a hell of a lot of money to you. It may be nothing to somebody else. So that value cannot be determined by the creator. With media is a very specific type of product. It's very, you know, it's here, it's gone. It's you know, what is it really worth? Well, that depends on what you got out of it. And you may have made a career decision based on what you heard. You may have made an investment decision. You may have made a life decision. You may have just laughed your ass off. Whatever it is, what was that worth to you? And I can give you some examples. You know, well, here's what a movie costs. You know, it's even, you spend less time at the movie. And if you take a date and have popcorn and drink a Coke, that's $50. So was our 3 hours worth $50? Up to you. And it turns out, and it's somehow, it's something that we also now understand very well with Bitcoin when it comes to value and time preference. I think time is a big part of it. People value things in wildly different ways than you'd expect. And we never look back because we said, yeah, $5, whatever, send whatever you want, whatever it's worth. A lot of people took our $5 suggestion. Quite a few sent 50 and a couple sent 500. Like, wow. Okay. Now, why someone values that at 500, I don't know. It's up to them. But if there's enough of them and enough just overall, I mean, shit, what a great system. If we're no good, people don't send us money. This will keep us really honest. And it took us years. I mean, it probably took, my goodness, 5 years at least until, you know, it was really at a level where now we barely had PayPal. I mean, we didn't have a lot of ways to send money. And so we've also always accepted money orders, cash, checks, send whatever. And it's just turned into a really good system. And we expanded it to call it something, the value for value model. And it's not just money, it's time, talent, and treasure. So we said, hey, you know, we need someone to set up servers and run servers. We got a lot of traffic. Boom, it was done. But then people, you know, and I've always done everything in structured data format. So all of our, everything's published, every story, every article, everything we do, every clip. And then people started putting together search engines. And then people started contributing art because it's cool to have a different piece of art for every episode. And then someone else made the art generator, right, so we can collect it all. And we have over 25,000 pieces in there now. I mean, just all of this stuff. So it became this tribe where everyone feels that they can have a part. And the most important thing is they're not listeners or fans or audience. They're producers. You're producing it with us. So everyone listening to this podcast or whatever podcast has at least one specialty that they know everything about. Everything there is to know about it, they'll know. And it's their job to break through the bullshit and not, you know, have, make sure there's good signal to noise, but they need to reach John and I when a topic comes up, or preferably before we discuss it. Mm-hmm. But if we discuss it and we don't have all the right information or we're full of crap, you need to reach out to us. And that's part of that information system that I was talking about. We really have to be able to collect all that stuff. And they are literally the producers of the show. So whereas there's no way, I mean, a podcast is barely sustainable with a host, let alone two. If you add a producer to it, you really can't make any money. It's just not there. Not an ad. I mean, yeah, of course, it's going to be an exception, but in general. So when you have thousands of people who just want to be a part of it and be recognized for their contribution, man, you got a product that is unbelievable. I mean, it truly is an unbelievable. Every single show is an unbelievable piece of work that a lot of people put energy into. And we're kind of the conduits and the conductors, but it comes from the whole piece. So my mission is to make sure that podcasting is protected. As it turns out, podcasting is very hard to cancel and to kill. And that's because it was concepted as a decentralized system from the get-go. Now, we did let Apple get a little too powerful in this equation. They kind of became the default on-ramp to podcasting, where all you need is a server, an MP3 file, and a text file that says that has XML data in it as RSS. That's all you need to be a podcast. So Apple was way too powerful. All the independent apps were kind of using their index. And they started messing around with it, and they started deplatforming people. I'm like, no, this will not stand. So I called up my buddy Dave Jones, and me and I have been building a lot of these information systems I've been telling you about for No Agenda and just podcasts in general. And I said, Dave, let's take this shit back. Let's put it down. We'll put the independent index. We'll offer a free API for any app developer to use it. And we're going to add in this Lightning Network to build a digital version of the value for value network. And this was typical me. We're in COVID bull crap. I build a Raspi Blitz. You know, I got a full node. I'm learning Lightning. I find Keysend. I'm like, holy crap, I can broadcast money. Wait a minute. I think I have an idea here. But when we brought this thing to life, you know, we had a couple months to spin up and get our databases filled up and get some basic things ready. All these people just came out of the woodworks. Holy crap. We've been waiting 10 years, you know, podcasting stagnant. I have a feature. I have a thing I want to do. Here's an idea. So now we have 15 new features in podcasting 2.0 above and beyond the value for value streaming payments. So this is some exciting shit going on. We have 20 different apps and services now that are using some or all of these of these features. And my job and my mission and my chapter now, maybe the last one, is to protect it. Make sure that, you know, the next generation of Joe Rogans have a place to be, to do their thing, to be, you know, protected from censorship, and also to be able to make a living and to be supported by their own tribe, their own community, with censorship resistant money, which is Bitcoin.
Right.
And so that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. I mean, I commend you. A lot of amazing work already, and it seems like way more to come. I really like this value for value notion, and you can see it in just the way you've built the show No Agenda and the way you interact with the audience. I do think podcasting, I wonder if you think, I think it connects with people on a much different level than other media forms. Maybe the only one I could really think of is maybe music, in the sense that, you think of like maybe your wedding song, or, you know, you made a life decision to a certain song. Most people don't do that during a sitcom or a movie or a book as much, especially in the current landscape. If podcasting continues to be protected and growing force in the media landscape, what do you think of where the media landscape is going, and in terms of where the stronger voices are going to be heard, or whether it's just going to get more fractionalized, or how's it going to go? And especially when you think of maybe like a Joe Rogan getting more listens or downloads than like CNN or NSBC or any of the big shows.
Well, I think that the way it's flowing naturally, and what I hope people focus on, is on creating your own tribe, your own community, your own audience, owning that as much as possible. So not leaving this up to third parties. And the reason why is we're going to eventually realize that it doesn't matter who has the most listeners. No, everybody wants to be relevant. So not everybody can be the number one with all the most. It's also not important anymore. This is what I've proven to myself. I come from a world where being the top of the ratings, the number one, you know, the best, that's really important because that just builds more. Turns out, I just wanted to get my rent paid. So John and I have not looked at ever at how many people listen to No Agenda. We don't care. We just want, can I pay my rent? Okay, that's all we care about. By coincidence, with podcasting 2.0, we had a moment in time where the stars were aligned because podcast measurement is very, very fuzzy. And we were able to see that No Agenda does have about 1.4, at least a year ago, 1.4 million people, unique wow. people who at one point were listening to it in that period of time, like a week. But it doesn't really matter anymore because, you know, this is kind of the OnlyFans thing where, you know, you only need 100 people to really right. sustain your life, you know, to keep you in busy and keep you fed. So it's much, and even any professional marketer, well, direct marketer certainly will tell you, you know, it's much better to take care of your existing, let's just call them customers for a moment, and nurture them and communicate with them than it is to get new right. people. In fact, with podcasting, the whole idea is to have the people who are listening to you to go out and tell more people about it. That's how it works. You know, you can advertise on Facebook, but it's going to be someone who tells their buddy yeah. or girlfriend, like, hey, or turns it on the car, you should listen to this. So we need to focus on the people who are communicating back at us, who are listening right now. That said, there's also something really cool about podcasting, which is, for me, was always the dream of any radio guy, is I have moved from your speakers, from your car speakers, from your boombox, into your motherfucking ear. I am in your head. So now you really hear me. So it's even more important I filter my microphone for this very reason. If you listen to it on, you know, a big, expensive hi-fi system, you're like, well, it's not exactly like the way I'd like to listen to it. No, because I know how people are listening. They're listening with earbuds. They're listening with headphones. And so there's so much more that can be done from a theater of the mind and sound perspective. Oh, my goodness. It's a dream. I love it. And that's part of the reason why people are, you know, why it works. People are hearing it. They can't not hear it. So it is very much like music in that regard, and it's very personal, and people build up a very personal relationship with their podcast, with their podcast app, with all kinds of things. And of course, if it's audio only, which is what I'm most interested in, then you can do other things at the same time. You can walk the dog, drive the car, you know, you can, and many people can work while they're listening to podcasts. Right. So it's not a detractor from your time. Again, another kind of Bitcoin value there.
Yeah, sure. I can see that. I'd love to turn to maybe deconstructing the news and the media a little bit. I'd love to hear what you think of the media sort of pivoting from COVID, the situation in the Ukraine with Russia.
My analysis of what's happening right now goes back to at least 2019. I believe that our problems are a financial problem and not a health or a geopolitical problem per se.
Right.
For 15 years, I've been, you know, conspiracy therapist. I've looked at everything, and holy moly, a lot of the stuff we've been talking about over the years kind of came true. And so too with a lot of fuzziness with COVID, and not all is malicious, but the media, politics, everything plays into it. But the banking sector and finance in general is really not understood. It's very complicated, especially with modern monetary theory, where you can create money and in bank reserves, and it's not really real until it's on the other side and the economy. And there's all these things. But the end of the day, the story is 8% inflation. Now, that's just a term they're using to tell you what you might be paying extra for your basket of goods. But of course, it's much higher than that because we don't all eat hamburger helper. Sometimes we eat a normal meal and we don't always get, you know, watered down gasoline. We get like, you know, 90 octane or something. So and they fuzzied with those rules throughout the years. But also most people just are not educated how the American system works. We have the petrodollar, which means that all oil is supposed to be sold, all oil products, petroleum, in dollars. We did a deal with Saudi Arabia for that with a bunch of Bedouin dudes, you know, with camels running around. And we said, hey, call yourself prince, king, whatever. We'll make you wealthy beyond your wildest dreams. Just keep selling it in dollars and we'll protect you with our enormous military that we have, which we built up with printed money. And because we have this reserve currency status in the United States with the dollar, we can print all we want. And that's what that kind of 2% inflation is that the Fed always talks about, because that means they're always printing 2% extra money at least. And that's how everything gets paid for. Taxes in the United States is really just a control mechanism. It's just to put you in your place, tax you one way, the other, screw you over. We can print anything. COVID proved that. You need $1.5 trillion? No problem, we'll print that. You need another trillion here? No problem, we'll print that. And of course, the result is what you'd expect it to be. I can't explain exactly what's happening with the financial system, but there's definitely insolvency going on within the banks. There's really no way out. And this is historically, there's never been a way out. There's never been a way out of a fiat system where the government gets a little out of control and typically may even, you know, use the money to build up an even stronger army, just so everyone knows that we keep using our money. And it started to fall apart. And this happened in 2008. This is when it happened. And then they shoved everything under the carpet. And in 2019, it started to come up again. And luckily, there was COVID, because what is the best way to stop hyperinflation is shut down the economy.
Yeah.
And so they shut it down. And under, you know, a health concern, I mean, I think by now the numbers are in and there may be some scientific consensus that lockdowns did a lot more damage than they did good. And in the middle of all this, you have a bunch of elites, in this case, they're bankers at the World Economic Forum. And I take these fuckers for their word. They're talking Great Reset. They're talking central bank digital currency. I mean, this is not new. They're also sadly talking about cyber pandemic. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of stuff, but I take them at their word now because this stuff is coming true. They did an event 201. Just 3 months before the actual COVID-19 hit. So, wow, they're clairvoyant at least. Now, a couple things went wrong. Well, okay, so I believe just looking at the general agenda of the world, the green agenda, climate change, believe in it or not, climate change has one goal, to remove petrochemical from our, you know, from our energy, certainly, but you know, there's a lot more that comes with that. I mean, you got to make concrete and pharmaceutical products. But okay, we need to remove this. So that is by definition an attack on the petrodollar. It is by definition intended to weaken the U.S. dollar. Well, right there if you remember the first stimulus bill, they're putting together the crazy $1.5 trillion, the first one that didn't pass. In there from Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders was the Digital Dollar Act. There was some setup going on. And I think ultimately the idea is, and we'll get to the war part, but it's obvious. The idea is to create demand destruction, make energy so expensive that we'll go back into lockdown, self-imposed, driverless Sundays, you know, carless Sundays, all this kind of stuff, moving towards our green agenda, and everyone's going to get a free electric vehicle. That may not happen right away, but I'm quite convinced that when people have to start staying home and trucks don't drive and it's just too expensive, that's when the stimmy checks will come back out. Except this time it'll be a central bank digital currency. It'll be the digital dollar. You'll have your special digital wallet. And then the control grid is pretty much collapsed on most people who didn't prepare for this moment. So war I'm not counting out Putin being in on this. Now, it's well known that he has always hated the petrodollar, and why can't it be in euros or rubles or what shekels, whatever he wants to be in, without getting into the geopolitics of Ukraine and Russia and who did what to whom. And, you know, I did follow the coup in Ukraine in 2014 quite closely. And, you know, we did play the call that Victoria Nuland made, where she's literally putting together the new government. Mm-hmm. But when you see all the different pieces and actors involved in the Ukraine story and how they're acting now, it seems like this is just a really handy way to say, okay, pay no attention to the printing press. It's Putin that's making your gas expensive.
Right.
It's Putin that's causing your food to be unavailable because of supply chains, et cetera, or, you know, a lot of it comes from Russia and Ukraine. So it's all Putin's fault. And this cancellation of Russia is unbelievable in scope and scale. I cannot believe that Google Maps does not show a 404 not found where Russia used to be. I mean, this is really, now you're fucking up a part of the global system. That's mm-hmm. going to hurt. And it's not just going to hurt Russia. So I can only conclude, Cedric, that this is intentional. And it is intentional because the financial system is at its end. And I'm not alone in saying this. I'm certainly the most uneducated of the people who are saying it, but there's a lot of really smart people who say it's over. There's just no way to do it anymore. And we can either take a drastic measure and get into a CBDC, or risk runaway inflation and real, real, real bad shit. And they're trying to kind of soft crash land this thing and cover it up with war, right. You know, because this war is not what we're being told about here on television. That much I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit of
a real tragedy. Yeah, but this is not about Ukraine. This is about the global financial system.
Right. The way these macro events are unfolding in regards to the global financial system, do you think that these events are unfolding in a way that's going to extend the American petrodollar and hegemony, or sort of is this sort of a design system or going through a phase that's designed to move us away from that? And I'm curious if America's leaders are trying to extend the petrodollar, or do we think that they're part of the movement away from the petrodollar?
I think they're all a part of the movement away. They're all invested in the new system. I mean, it's so big, and this is where ESG comes into play. I mean, why are we no longer energy independent in the United States? It's not just because of Biden, you know, shutting down the pipeline and doing other things, but the environmental social governance driven by mainly Larry Fink and BlackRock makes it impossible for anyone to invest in energy companies of so-called dirty energy, because they literally have been almost outlawed by their ESG score. And this is why you see every oil energy company pulling out of Russia, virtue signaling. Oh, we're out. We're not in. We're not going to. And, you know, that's also going to hurt the overall energy system. So 100%. Now, they're also idiots. I mean, they really believe that this will work. Now, the smart ones, and I'll say Bill Gates, they're also invested in nuclear because they know that this is not going to work. So luckily, there's a backstop there with nuclear, and it'll have to come into play. And some natural gas will always have to remain. And I think we'll actually get ramped up because people will be very cold and be problems. But look at Europe. These guys, I mean, it was Europe who booted Russia off of SWIFT, not Joe Biden. The European Union passed legislation to kick them off SWIFT. They're committing suicide. Yeah. They need Russian gas more than anybody else. So, you know, this has to be intentional. The question is, will it be the U.S. CDBC? You know, whose network is going to be valuable? Who's going to own the network and the quote-unquote money, the token, that people want to use? Jay Powell himself has said, well, you know, there's been times in the past where more than one currency was the reserve currency of the world. I don't know why he said that. Or there could be two side by side. So I don't know. I don't know what that means. But I think they desperately want to get off the petrodollar and have the digital control. And in that case, I mean, when you're talking 16 digits behind the decimal, you know, right. You can create and destroy money, and you can program it and make it usable for this, but not for that, have it expire. I mean, that's a total dream. I would say it's probably likely China comes into our system and China becomes part of our digital currency. I'm not so sure that they would want to have their own. I think they would probably look at being inside of our digital currency as more powerful than their entire army, because their economy is so big. They can do right. a lot. They could leverage really drive a lot.
So, yeah, it seems like there's been a merger there.
So when it comes to America, Bitcoin is America 2.0.
Yeah.
And we have a physical location, but it's a mindset, brother. It's a mindset. And I love it. I'm 57. I love working with the 27, 28 year old people, mainly guys right now, but there's women coming in too. I love seeing this thinking. It's apolitical. It's like, no. We see the problem. We see if we can fix this one part, it's a lot of other pieces will fall into place. And I think it's interesting to see how much waffling's going on amongst the elites. I mean, the European Union, first they were going to have legislation, proof of work currencies. No, this is evil. We can't have that, climate change. No, they walked that back. I think they're keeping the escape hatch open for themselves.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious. I think you have a military intelligence, or your family has a CIA background.
Yeah.
Has that organization changed, in your opinion, over the years and decades?
Well, I'm black sheep of the family because I'm a college dropout. Although my dear uncle, Don Gregg, who was national security advisor to Bush Sr., very senior in the CIA, goes back to OSS days. He says, Adam, man, sure made a hell of a lot more money than I ever did. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, but Don, you know, you got to blow up countries and shit. Yes. And they, my uncle and other family members would be the first to say, back in the day, CIA was Catholics in action, and they jumped out of airplanes and saved the world. And that's what they did. Even that was not true at the time, because it's always been information and propaganda, and really information. That's really what it's, you know, intelligence is all about. They're not really the central assassination agency, although, you know, you'd think they are. So they're much more about information. Of course, they have access to a lot more now. The agency, I think, has drastically changed. It's as of many agencies.
Sure.
They're out of control, quite honestly. The CIA is out of control. FBI is out of control. They have there's always going to be great people, but it's no longer is the agency what it used to be. And there's a lot of grousing about that from people I hear, right. You know, I talk to sometimes, like, this is crazy. It's not at all what it used to be. But, you know, it was always unchecked, and unchecked power goes unchecked. And, you know, absolute power can always corrupt absolutely. And I think that the situation we're in now, where we have the same, all the institutions, people are losing faith in institutions because they're showing their buttholes now. We're seeing the pharmaceuticals being full of crap. Education, of course, huge issue, difference of opinion, difference of what their role is versus the parents' role. So pharma, of course, media, broadcast, journalism, all these things are crap. All politicians, you just got to put them all in one lump and say, first of all, a lot of them are a little too old to be running the show right now. I don't want to be ageist, but get the fuck out. Mm-hmm. It's really time. But the corruption and the system is just not good. Now, my generation, big blame for this. We were partying in the 80s and 90s. We were making money, making careers, having a good time, having kids, big houses, great, great, great time. I wasn't paying attention to who was in city council, who was on the school board. That's clearly some loser who couldn't get a better gig. Well, lo and behold, I'll put hand in my vest for that. So while we create parallel systems, you can't fix this. Right. And this is what I love about the millennials. Create the parallel system. Let the other shit collapse onto itself and learn. We're learning how to create our own schools. We're learning about food. We're learning how to get food from ranchers, from farmers. We're learning how to distribute. We're learning how to share. Off-the-shelf technology is enabling doctors to create concierge health services for their community, 300 people instead of 3,000 and no time, instead of crazy fees. Maybe once we've figured out all these systems, we'll go, oh, we can probably get someone elected who we like too and who would make sense. So we're going to get there. And that is the real American part of it. What's great about Bitcoin is I'm seeing it as a bonding mechanism. Once people hold it and use it and then see how the price action works and the inflation, mm-hmm. The controlled inflation and the policy, it's even for a VJ, you know, I understand it now. Like, oh, okay. So instead of running in place and just slipping backwards because of, you know, the devaluation of your money and other issues that come along with that, hey, you know, it's like I'm saving for the first time in a long time. It's like I'm not going to buy that right now because, you know, in 5 years, this what I hold in my hands could be worth twice as much. No, I don't want it. It's not that important to me. So you learn that, and Bitcoin can touch every piece of the chain. So podcasting 2.0, we made very specific that when someone is sending value to a podcaster, that value is also a little piece distributed to the app that you're using, the app developer. The podcaster can also make splits and send, you know, have a piece go to their co-host or their producer. So the whole ecosystem is built around everybody benefiting. And that's why this project that we're doing works, which is an open project, also value for value. We have no investors, no mm-hmm. outside money, only the Satoshis that we make 1% of all transactions, all voluntary. People love doing it. Because everybody gets a piece of it. Everybody is incentivized. And so right now, another buddy of mine, Texas Slim, who also kind of came out of retirement to start the beef initiative and to connect ranchers with people, help them on, you know, food intelligence. He's doing conferences about this now, bringing in more ranchers, retailers, restaurants, and all the transaction goes through Bitcoin. And I can't explain why it is, but the fact that Bitcoin is a part of that, because you're kind of going outside of all the systems, including the credit card mechanisms, people gravitate towards it. We have a secret decoder ring, you know, there's something about it, like, yes, it's Bitcoin, bitch. You know, it's like, yeah, of course, that's how we roll. And that's the bonding glue. Why this is, we have to ask Satoshi Nakamoto perhaps one day, but it works. It really works. It's a very, very cool thing to see. Much bigger than the dollar that I've ever witnessed, this bond.
Yeah, I think the bond, I think food intelligence is very important. Texas Slim has been on the show twice, popular episodes.
What am I telling you? You know no, about Texas.
But he spent some time in the intelligence industry, private in the telecommunications. Yes. I was reading about your uncle on Wikipedia, and I love that sort of that euphemism. He was tapped by the CIA while at university, and I'm like, I kind of like how the MTV called you, but I always think of that as a little different. It's probably not a little tap on the shoulder, but I'm how do they really find these people?
I just found something out about my family that I wanted to share. So Don's wife, Meg, she just passed away 2.5 weeks ago. He's 94, she's 91. So she's had a very good life. Now, I always knew that obviously she knows what Don does. He was also ambassador to Korea. So, you know, she's and they've lived in all over Asia and done all kinds of dodgy shit. But during, you know, this getting to know, you know, her a little bit more from the family and eulogies and stories that come out. Turns out, well, I knew that she was at one point CIA. So she was actually in CIA before Don. She, I think she ran the Russia desk, spoke fluent Russian, which I did not know. She actually outranked him. And this kind of came up later. I'm like, holy crap, she was a great spy. Nobody knew. No one knew at all that she was in this. But, you know, it's just, it's a strange business. And most of my family is intelligence or military. And I even though they've, a lot of them have been involved in stuff that they might not even be proud of, I know that every single one of them always did this from a patriotic heart, a good place. And I think that maybe even now in hindsight, when you really see, you know, because we're kind of seeing how the sausage is made overall, and it may not, maybe it wasn't that bad 40 years ago, but it's gotten pretty murky what's going on. And these are very, very patriotic, upstanding, church-going, God-fearing, America-loving people. And that rubbed off on me.
Yeah, I could see that. That's awesome. Another question I have for you then, I guess, is what did you make of, I guess, Trump going to Russia very early on in the 80s and then coming back and sort of speaking about presidential runs through the 80s and 90s? I'm just kind of curious what you made of that, or just was he always had presidential aspirations to you or something?
Well, I don't know about his Russia trip, but I was in New York in the mid 80s. When New York, you know, you could go to Times Square and get killed. You know, now you go to Times Square, you can get drunk, fall down. You won't even hurt your face because it's all Disney rubberized. You know, you bounce right back up. And so this was a time when Dinkins was mayor when we got there. Then Giuliani came in with Police Chief Bratton, and they cleaned that city up. I saw it happen, and it did not take long. I was like, where'd the squeegee go? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, yeah, they must have thrown him in the East River. It was a no broken windows concept. Like, you break a window, you're getting in trouble for that. We're not letting anybody off for anything. And it turned into something really great. And Trump at the time was really, I mean, hip hop was just starting. Hip hoppers were doing songs about him. He was, certainly for that period, it was the American dream. Look at this guy. I mean, and he just said something and did it, like Woman Skating Rink. Like, yeah, I'm just, you know, they've been dicking around with the skating rink. I'm going to make a skating rink. We'll just do it. And he did it. And everybody had his number, by the way. Everybody knew Trump. You come on the morning show, do whatever. And he was Donald. It was like, this is fantastic. This guy was bigger than life. The bravado, everything, the models, it was the scandal. It was perfect. He embodied New York. But of course, he never really fit in with the true elite New York set. And when I've never really paid that much attention to his presidential runs, but in 2015, I think when he announced, I said right away, oh, he's going to be president. There's no doubt about it in my mind. I knew it right away because I pick the hits. I know the hits. I know what people want, and whether it's technology or a news story. I even picked this Pope. It's going to be this guy from Argentina. That was my best one, by the way. I've done a couple of good predictions. That was one of my better ones. But Trump, like, oh, totally. It's so obvious to me. And I really hoped for it too. I really wanted it. We always say for the show, the show will be so fun when we have Trump in the world. And it became almost, it actually hurt us a lot because we just look at the mainstream media or media in general. So when the media was talking shit that just wasn't true, we're like, the media is full of shit. And then you become a Trump apologist. Just like now, if you don't start off your sentence with, look, Putin's a fucking murderer, you can't say anything.
Right.
And so, you know, and we just won't do that. Yeah, everyone's full of crap. Everyone in this position is a murderer. That's not the point. Why is this happening? What is the real scenario? We're all distracted by horrible images, which, you know, like, hello, that's been used for a long time. The real tragedy is knowing Europe and knowing the migration tragedy they've had so far the past 20 years. now they have, you know, 2-3 million more refugees slash migrants. I mean, this is a very, very big problem. It's much bigger than what's going on in Ukraine itself right now. And it's a problem for the refugees and for the hosting countries. We've seen this problem. Europe is in deep, deep trouble in this regard. So, he messed up a lot of plans. And I think, first of all, right now, you and I were supposed to be locked down talking on Zoom with Hillary Clinton as our president, promising a vaccine in 2 more years. I mean, I'm quite convinced of it. So that was not supposed to go that way. But a lot of things were in motion because, again, we have a financial issue. This is not a secret. This has been known for a decade at least that this has to be fixed. And, you know, they're getting there. So, you know, we've been talking about digital dollars and all this for a long time. And now there's an actual bill. Okay. I'm sorry, an executive order. An executive order that says, hey, we got to do this for real. 6 months. We have our plans finalized. Come back and, you know, you have to report. But this is really happening. It's right. Not just like two kooks on a podcast. This shit is really happening. You know, it's like, you know, we're protecting ourselves in more ways than one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're doing the same. I think you're very smart to get out of the Chicago area.
Yeah. I'm trying to do my best, trying to make the hard choices to get the easy life instead of the easy choices and getting the hard life. It hasn't been easy. You know, the terms weren't completely my own over the last 2 years. So but we're trying to figure it out as best we can and do what's best.
You're
for the
doing
family.
A great American thing, man. This is what Americans do. It's like, hey, man, I'm going to move east or west. I'm going to try something else and take your family. And the family is all in and you do it. And
that's
a cool thing.
I think if you enjoy your freedom or your personal sovereignty, it's hard to have certain things thrust upon you. And it's almost sort of like you just got to shake it off, or it's just really hard to stand. So the last 2 years were really difficult.
Shit.
Yeah. On everybody, of course.
Yeah.
I went into the lockdown thinking, how can I transform my life during this period? I started the podcast about 6 months after the lockdown. And part of that was to, bring technology into the home, to show my kids a certain medium and to get something off the ground and hopefully come out of the pandemic with more control over my life instead of less, considering that lockdowns and these kinds of abnormities could be a part of modern life. And so I wanted to be able to work from home under my complete control and not for another company or corporation anymore. I mean, I spent 25 years as a spreadsheet jockey, a corporate accounting consultant. I think part of it is Bitcoin, or a huge part of it. You know, Bitcoin came into my life and I couldn't stop talking about it. And I needed an outlet as well to meet other people to talk about it. And then I wanted to meet people who had not just found Bitcoin, but found lots of other things in truth and follow those ideas and threads. And to touch on what you mentioned before, I think part of that bonding is, I think of Bitcoin as a language. So it's a new way of communicating, and sort of like podcasting was a new medium for me to take in information and communicate. And it reminded me of talk radio in the sense that you could be in the room, be in the party, but I liked it more than talk radio because it was long form conversation rather than sort of that zoo jockey mentality that you have in the morning radio. So in that regard, do you think of Bitcoin as big a pillar as communications or radio or broadcast in your life? You know, I mean, I know you spent a whole life in communications, so and Bitcoin's much newer, but do you see it on the same level in that regard?
It's bigger. Bitcoin is bigger than podcasting, but it was so logical that someone like me would figure out how to put the two together, which really came naturally. This was not a hard thing. It's like, I want to broadcast money at the same time I'm receiving MP3. That should be possible.
Bits for
well,
bits.
Boom, boom, there it is. And it's just ones and zeros, right? It's just one you interpret this way and the other you interpret another way. I would say the thing about Bitcoin is I can talk to you and I know a lot about your values. That's it. You can be Japanese, you can be in El Salvador, you can be in Amsterdam, you can be in France, you can be anywhere in the world. And I talk to you and you're a Bitcoiner. Oh, I already know a lot about you. And I'm already going to automatically be attracted to you because we share some very core fundamental values right there. That I think that's really what it is. I mean, when have we had something like that? I mean, I'm a podcaster. Yeah, that's almost like I'm a day trader, you know. I don't know if that sounds, I always find it weird. Hey, man, you're a podcaster. I'm like, that really sounds shit somehow. It doesn't sound great. But it is part of the same thing. It is, I have something to say. Bitcoin allows you to say something. Podcasting allows you to say something. Bitcoin is just, I mean, we're fortunate to have Bitcoin as a part of podcasting 2.0. I don't think Bitcoin needed podcasting, but man, does it make sense for those two to be together. It's just, I mean, this is a circular economy. They're getting Bitcoin and they're sending it to people and they're doing it willingly and attaching messages and using numerology to send certain amounts to either as a handle or as a good luck charm or just as a joke. So they're very oddly in touch with the underlying asset and also completely removed from it, which is a really, really fantastic thing to see. But when I hear people say, this is the most fun I've had parting with my money, come on, fiat, do that. Do that.
Yeah. If you could orange pill anyone, who would it be?
I'm working on Joe Rogan. I've been working on it for 2 years. He knows a lot more than he's letting on. He's got a lot of people yapping at him. We text regularly, but we like to do the bigger stuff in person when we're doing the show. Because he'll usually say, hey, we got stuff to talk about. Can you do the show? Yeah. And then, by the way, hey, if someone can't make it, can you do the show? Yeah, man, I'm there too. Don't worry about it. Consider me your Tony Randall. I'm getting there. It's taken a bit, you know. It's always interesting whenever I'm on Joe's show, and you know, Bitcoin always comes up. The Bitcoin Twitter, I should say, immediately is like, no, you didn't do it right. You need this guy. He needs to go on Rogan and explain. The bottom line is, anyone who's a Bitcoiner knows, no one can explain Bitcoin to you. You have to get the spark and then you got to go look at it yourself. That's how you learn and understand Bitcoin. It can't just be one person telling you this is what it is. Right. It has to motivate someone to go and do a little bit of work themselves and dive into it. Joe's very fortunate. He has a lot of really smart people on the show. He knows a hell and has opinions that he does not tell people. That's obvious. But I would love to orange pill Joe. So he just says, I'm a Bitcoiner.
Yeah, that'd be unreal.
I'll make him a maxi.
There you go. That'd be awesome. What can people do for podcasting? People, you know, who just listen and they want to get more involved or contribute or help the cause.
First of all, we need everybody. And we need people like you to just keep doing it right off the bat. The easiest thing to do to protect, extend, and enhance podcasting is to ask people to try a modern podcast app. And at newpodcastapps.com, there's a whole bunch of them, all platforms. You can even sort it by which ones will do value for value streaming Satoshis. And of course, it's not just for that, but there's many features as well. I would hope that people who have a good experience then also tell other podcasters they listen to, hey, here's something cool. Because when you do, you can't help yourself but support the podcast. We've made it so efficient. You can do one sat a minute if you want. You know, I do 100 sats a minute. So, and I listen to a podcast for an hour. you know, today's price is $2.50 for an hour. Seems fair. If 1,000 people did that, now you're starting to support people really simply, transparently, in the background. You don't have to think about it. Oh, I really like something. Hit a boost. Send a boostagram. It's working. It is working. We're doing like 70,000 transactions a month. And that's just of our, you know, of our 1% of all the transactions that are happening out there. We're probably the biggest by transaction volume, the biggest on the Lightning Network. I mean, it's insane what's going on. Get into that, people, so that when you wake up in the morning, if Apple or Spotify has decided to kick your favorite podcast off, it won't be gone. It'll be there. Through our Podping system, when they update, you know, sometimes Apple can take a couple hours. No, this is usually within 90 seconds that it updates on modern podcast apps. Lots more features. You can even have people who are producing, listening, audience, create things for you that will go into the podcast, like our cloud chapter, so someone else can create chapters and it'll just flow in, so you don't have to do all the work. I mean, there's just so much stuff that can be done. But for me personally, the most important is protect podcasting by using a modern app that uses the index, which is open. Anybody can download the whole database. You can put it under your pillow if you want, create your own index. I mean, everything is open source. Everything is open. Everything is supported by the podcasting community at large, which is millions of people listening and creating. Support that's all. And the best way to support it was the newpodcastapps.com. That's the best way to support podcasting.
Awesome, Adam. This
and
has
Bitcoin.
This has been so dope, really incredible. Please let people know where they can find you and your work.
So podcastindex.org is the main site, and we have a Mastodon, so you can follow me, Adam, at noagendasocial.com. But I'm also on Twitter at Adam Curry, but that's more like an inbox of vomit. So if you really want to have a chat, Adam at noagendasocial.com. And I wanted to say to you, man, first of all, thank you. We scheduled this a long time ago, and I'm glad we connected. God bless on your journey with your family, and let me know when y'all have landed in Florida. We have infrastructure in Florida, so the stuff you need, you know, anything we can do to help, Matt, and good luck on your grand adventure, your big American adventure.
Thank you so much. We're really enjoying it. We're just loving this road trip through America. It's been so great. Thank you so much.
It's a great thing to do, and I think your kids will look back on this. You know, they'll be pissed off at you for a couple of the motels, but in the long run, man, they're going to be real happy they did this.
Yeah, fortunately, they like the one we're in tonight, so it's got a loft and the cabin, so that's great. Thank you so much, man.
My pleasure.
If you enjoy the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, all I ask is that you tell your friends and family about the show and write a 5-star review on iTunes. Those are the best way to help the show grow and gain new listeners. This episode was brought to you by CipherSafe and Ledin. And thank you for listening. Stack stats, stay humble, and stay laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.